royal prerogative. Earlier, when I talked about parliamentary supremacy as being the most important principle of our Constitution, this came about in 1688. Now, during the 1600s in England, there was a series of civil wars, eventually led to the resolution in 1688 for those who supported Parliament rather than the absolute monarchy held the day. So it was recognized in 1688 that Parliament had the power to change any of the King's powers. And the King's powers were the royal prerogative. So up until 1688, the King could do anything. Bit of a simplification, that's more or less the case. After 1688, Parliament would erode the power of the monarch and make and pass laws. Of course, Parliament consists part, well, it's the House of Lords, the House of Commons, and the monarch. In Canada, Parliament is the House of Commons, the Senate, and the monarch, represented by the Governor General. So, Parliament in Canada has not taken away the royal prerogative with regard to international affairs. So that is why the Prime Minister has so much power. The Parliament could decide to erode the royal prerogative there. And this is what Irvin Student says would not be a good idea. So any questions about that? Yes?
Is there any, I'm sure, not necessarily that you know the literature, is there any reason why they don't?
Yes, exactly, for the reasons that Professor Student gave you. That it's considered by most people that the government needs the ability to act quickly with regard to foreign affairs. Now, by tradition, major foreign affairs decisions are debated in Parliament. They don't have to be, but they are debated. So when Canada got involved in Afghanistan, the Liberal government had Parliament approve that. We had a debate in Parliament, and it was approved by Parliament. Similarly, with regard to Canada's involvement in Afghanistan, when it was extended, Prime Minister Harper went to Parliament because it's so crucial. But he didn't have to. Neither the Liberals nor the Conservatives had to go to Parliament. And the royal prerogative was not reduced. They just wanted Parliament's approval of that measure. Yes?
So I know in our last pass we did a lot of, we picked some hot button issues that the professor before the courts or has been. And I was wondering why that argument applies in the case of foreign policy and not in other cases, right? But why are our courts too slow? They're too slow for foreign policy, but nothing, no other.
Not only too slow, but they don't have the expertise necessarily with regard to certain international relations issues. Now, Professor Student mentioned the Khadr case. Omar Khadr was a Canadian who, when he was 15 years old, taken by his father to fight for Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. Omar didn't want to go, but his father made him go. He was eventually captured by the U.S., and he was blamed for killing a U.S. Soldier. There's a lot of evidence that he couldn't possibly have done it. In any case, he was 15 years old, a child soldier. He should have been rehabilitated, not prosecuted. The U.S. took him to Guantanamo. They wouldn't give him a lawyer. Eventually, Canadians sent officials to meet with him. The Canadian officials from defense and international affairs didn't give him a lawyer for a long time, but they questioned him after he'd been tortured. They then shared that information with the U.S. That information was used at his so-called trial at Guantanamo Bay. The Supreme Court of Canada said that since Khadr was a Canadian, there are a few instances where the Charter of Rights and Freedoms applies extraterritorially. Where Canadian officials do something that is contrary to the Charter and has a huge impact on human rights. This is such a case. So in two Khadr decisions, the Supreme Court of Canada unanimously said that Khadr's rights were violated. In the second decision, Khadr wanted a remedy. The remedy was to be brought back to Canada. The Supreme Court said the correct remedy is to bring him back to Canada. But since that's a decision under the royal prerogative, we cannot force the government to bring him back. But we highly recommend it. Within a few minutes after that decision, Harper said, nothing doing. He's staying there. We trust the Americans.
So that's why that is so controversial and why it's such a hot button issue. And when we get into our class in March, is it okay with you if we discuss that in more detail?
Yeah.
Great. So here's the boring part, the rules of statutory interpretation. So rules are needed because legislation is often unclear, and the judges need to have some sort of consistent way of interpreting them so they're not all over the place. So they take into account what they consider to be the intent of the legislature. Now, the intent of the legislature is really a grammatical analysis of the legislation. Since 1976, the courts have admitted legislative history as evidence, that is, the records of the debates in Parliament or a provincial legislature, as it may be. But they do not take that evidence as determinative, because it's only individual members of the legislature speaking about what they think the legislation means. So all they take into account is the final vote in terms of interpreting legislative intent. There is a reasonable person test. What would a reasonable person do in interpreting this legislation if they were informed of the relevant facts? You'll see that mentioned in a number of cases. There's the plain meaning rule. If there's a difference in interpretation, you take the most straightforward, simple interpretation. There's the golden rule. The legislature did not intend to be absurd or inconsistent. Even though it may read that way, they didn't intend to be absurd or inconsistent, so we have to interpret the legislation in a way that is not absurd or inconsistent. What was the mischief? There's an assumption that all legislation is designed to tackle a problem. In legal language, the problem is the mischief. So the question is, what was the mischief? And what is the remedy for the mischief that is affected through the legislation? Specific words help to explain general ones that are nearby. So precedence is given to the specific words rather than general words. We'll see this in the trade and commerce cases when the courts are trying to sort out what can the feds do under their trade and commerce power, what do the provinces do under property and civil rights. Turns out that property and civil rights is more specific than trade and commerce, hence this helps the provinces. Okay. If a piece of legislation specifically includes certain areas, that means that the legislature intended to exclude the areas that they didn't specifically mention. There are interpretation statutes in every jurisdiction in Canada that aid the courts in interpreting the statutes in that jurisdiction. And at the beginning of most statutes, there's a series of definitions that help the judges to interpret the legislation. Sometimes they take a look at the context of specific parts as part of the whole of the statute. We'll see that especially in some recent Supreme Court decisions. They may look at other similar statutes where the meaning is clearer. I already mentioned legislative history, that is the debates in Parliament or a legislature. It's given minimal weight because it's just the opinions of individuals talking. Books written by people like Peter Hogg or Patrick Monahan on statutory interpretation. There are legal dictionaries that they refer to sometimes. Now, in Canada, we're lucky because federally and in provinces like Ontario and Quebec and Manitoba and New Brunswick, all the statutes are published in English and French. In Ontario, it's not required that statutes be in French, but they just do this to honor the more than 500,000 francophones in the province. Now, if the English text is unclear, the francophone text may be clear, or vice versa. Sometimes, and more often, the courts are looking at international treaties. In other words, to implement a treaty, it has to be implemented domestically, either in provincial or federal legislation. But if Canada signed a treaty, that means that Canada intended to abide by the terms of the treaty, and therefore, if the words of a specific statute are unclear, then the international treaty may help the judges to understand the meaning of the statute. So, for example, in the Immigration Act, a very famous case called Baker, the Supreme Court of Canada, in interpreting whether the Immigration Department should take into account Mrs. Baker's status as having had several children born in Canada before she's being deported. They took into account Canada's international obligations under a treaty with regard to children, the rights of children. And they said, look, the Immigration Department didn't consider the impact on Baker's children having her deported. They sent it back to the Immigration Department to say, think about the kids. They allowed her to stay. The preamble to statutes is sometimes considered, because the preamble says, whereas such and such and such and such and such and such. Sometimes that sheds light on the specific meaning later on in the statute. But there are marginal notes in most statutes just helping you to find your way through the statute more quickly. Those are not taken into account. There are headings before various parts of statutes quite often. Most of the time, those are taken into account as helping to describe what the statute means. But in Ontario, by law, taking into account the headings is excluded. And then there are various presumptions that help in judicial interpretations. In criminal law, there's a presumption in favor of the criminal accused. So where the law is unclear, interpret it in favor of the accused person, because the accused person does not have as much power as the state. In taxation law, in favor of the taxpayer. I remember about 10 years ago, I had an argument with Revenue Canada over deductions for one of my kids who was going to a special school because of a handicap he had. They decided they weren't going to allow the deduction, and so I was able to point out that the law is very unclear here, so therefore you have to interpret it in my favor. I won! Didn't even have to go to court. I think they just got tired of hearing from me. There's a presumption against changing the common law, that is, the judge-made law. There's a presumption that the Crown has to prove mens rea, in other words, the guilty mind, unless there is an express statement of absolute liability. We'll get into that principle more in one of the cases that we talk about in February. So just keep that in mind for now. There's a presumption against statutes applying retroactively. They can apply retroactively. Usually changes to our income tax apply retroactively, but they have to be put into the legislation. Otherwise, there's a presumption that they don't. If it's unclear in terms of a privative clause that to what extent the courts are prevented from considering a certain issue, there's a presumption that the courts are not excluded. So privative clauses have to be very, very clear and precise. There's a presumption in favor of Crown immunity, that is, you can't sue the Crown. Either the Crown, that's the executive, You can't sue the federal executive or the provincial executive, but that presumption has been replaced by statutes which allow people to sue the Crown in most jurisdictions now. Sometimes it's a little bit tougher than suing an ordinary person. There's a presumption that every word is deliberate, is intended to be there. I already mentioned specific given precedence over general. More recent legislation takes precedence over older legislation. Legislation did not intend drafting errors. So if there are grammatical errors in the legislation, comma is missing, and so on, and that might change the meaning of the legislation. The courts will just read the legislation as if there were no grammatical errors, and there's correct punctuation. Okay, so those are some of the rules of statutory interpretation. Any questions before we go on to something more interesting? Good. So, liberal democracies promote freedom, and that is liberty. And John Stuart Mill is one of the great theorists in the 1800s of what liberty means in a liberal democracy such as the United Kingdom or Canada, or the United States. And he argued that freedoms should only be limited by governments to prevent harm. So that's the harm principle. So, he argued, for example, that governments shouldn't even go so far as to legislate against drunkenness. He went on to say, though, that everyone in a liberal democracy has a moral responsibility to assist other people to help them better their lives. But that's an individual responsibility, not a government responsibility. So maximum freedom, except to prevent harm. In other words, laws can be passed to prevent drunken people from harming others, like drinking and driving legislation. But if they want to get drunk in their own house, that's their business. When there are limits to freedom, he argued that there should be procedural fairness, and that's what we call a due process. Fair procedures when you're called to court. And equality of applications of rights and freedoms to everyone. Now, in every liberal democracy, there are limits to rights. Sometimes it's because of differences in abilities, such as driver's licenses, or you have to go through medical school to become a doctor. To promote honesty, so there are limits to freedom of speech. You can sue people for defaming you. We're going to talk in the March class about litigation with regard to hate speech in Canada. The need to preserve public order. That is the old story about hollering fire in a movie theater when there is no fire. The need to deal with emergencies. And Professor Student mentioned that the Emergency Act passed in the late 1980s has not been litigated yet, but it does possibly limit our rights in the case of the four kinds of emergencies that he mentioned. Sometimes rights conflict with each other, and when we get into the class, well, next month and the month after, we'll see examples of where the judges have to balance two conflicting rights. And then sometimes there are community-wide restrictions on moral behavior. And in March, we're going to be talking about how the courts have treated pornography legislation. So why is it that in liberal democracies like Canada, we're concerned about rights? Well, one is the political theory of liberalism, which really developed over hundreds of years from the time of the Renaissance forward. And really, part of the Glorious Revolution in 1688 in England was accepting this theory that part of the purpose of the state was to promote maximum liberty and to promote human rights. The Protestant Reformation had a lot to do with thinking about rights, and of course Protestants believed they ought to communicate directly with God in terms of what rights were instead of being told by other people. So there was a lot of writing from the time of the Protestant Reformation on that dealt with human rights. And then, of course, in the Roman Catholic Church as well, later on. John Locke had a lot to do with our thinking about human rights. In the 1680s, 1670s, during one of the civil wars in England, John Locke was actually a physician. He was the physician for one of the leaders of the Parliamentary Party, the people that wanted parliamentary supremacy and the right to limit the powers of the monarch. Because of his support for the Parliamentary Party, he actually had to go into exile in Holland for almost a decade, during which time he thought a lot about the nature of government. And after 1688, when Parliament won the power to restrict the royal prerogative, Parliament became supreme. He wrote a book called the Second Treatise on Government, in which he defended this new type of government, which was quite revolutionary in England and had never been heard of in the continent of Europe. One reason why the French Revolution was so bloody was that after the revolution in England in 1688, the French monarch tried to suppress all forms of democracy. So that by the time of the French Revolution, the French had had very, very little experience with the community participating in decision-making, which is a lesson for other parts of the world that have also been suppressed as much as France was in the 16 and 1700s. So Locke said there should be one, he defined the rule of law, there should be one rule for the rich and poor, for the favored at court and the countrymen at plow. Why should there be one rule for the rich and the poor, for everybody? This is what Dicey talks about later on, about the rule of law. Law applies equally to everyone, no matter what their station in life is, including the people that are governing us. No one can be exempt from the law. Why was that? Well, first of all, Locke was a physician. Secondly, he considered himself a theologian. He was a very, what we would call, liberal theologian, but he's written a great deal about what Christianity means. And for him, in a nutshell, it means equal treatment of everyone. Everyone is equally a child of God, and therefore deserves to be treated equally. So, therefore, the law, God intended the law to apply equally to everyone and for everyone to be treated fairly. He went on to say that in terms of enforcing the law, if we try to enforce the law ourselves, we get too heated in our own defense. We often overreact, and therefore there needs to be an impartial body to administer the laws. Therefore, judicial independence. Now, Dicey argued that the common law, if it's properly applied by judges, is all that we need to protect human rights and individual freedom. So, for example, and Dicey gives this example, in 1765, a fellow by the name of Entick had his property searched on the order of a cabinet minister. There was no search warrant. Entick went to court and successfully sued the cabinet minister for violation of the law, because there was no law that authorized the cabinet minister to order the search. So that's held out by Dicey and many others is a good example of how the common law and the application of the rule of law is all that we need. Dicey was very much against a constitutional charter of rights or bill of rights because it's not flexible enough. there's the presumption of mens rea. the guilty mind. If someone doesn't, if they don't know what they're doing, that is, if they're insane, they can't be convicted of a crime. The Crown has to prove a case beyond a reasonable doubt. So in criminal cases, the standard of proof is very high in order to protect individual freedom. Confessions need to be given freely. They can't be given under duress or torture. No one can be forced to self-incriminate. And there are a number of what we call prerogative writs, such as habeas corpus. The prerogative writ is of habeas corpus, and this comes from judicial inheritance for the royal prerogative. A judge can go to a jail and ask for the reason why someone is being detained. And if someone is not being detained legally, the judge can order that person to be released. So over time, democratic values have grown in Canada and other liberal democracies. A lot has been written about the democratic character, what is needed through the education system to make us democratically sensitive. Now, at the time when Locke wrote about the importance of equality, it's interesting that only 5% of Englishmen could vote. And it remained about 5% for a long time, and eventually went up to 10 or 15 or 20%. But it was only in the last century that we had the universal franchise in most liberal democracies. So it took a long time for that equality principle, which Locke wrote about so clearly in 1691, to be translated into a universal franchise, which didn't occur in Canada until 1960, when native peoples finally got the right to vote. And it was between the 19-teens and the 1940s when women got the right to vote in various jurisdictions in Canada. And, of course, in the late 1800s, early 1900s, people of color were prevented from voting in a number of jurisdictions. So, just it takes a long time. Democracy doesn't happen all at once. It takes a long time to develop. It takes a lot of debate and discussion about the meaning of equality. And that's why in countries that haven't been democratic, it's going to be a long time before they become democratic. In the United States, the Americans developed the Bill of Rights, mostly so that the states could protect themselves against what they feared would be encroachment from the central government. The fact that the Americans have a Bill of Rights and that they've boasted about it so much has obviously influenced Canadians in terms of thinking about rights as well. I mentioned to you the two parts of our 1867 Constitution that are really a mini Bill of Rights, and those are the sections protecting denominational school rights and language rights. So, because of our bilingual and bi-religious heritage, we've been thinking about at least denominational school rights and language rights for a long time. I've talked about Dicey already. It's 5 o'clock now, and I think that a number of you need to go home. Is that right? You've got family, some of you? Spouses, other duties. So, I think that at the beginning of the next class, I'll start to talk about civil liberty cases prior to the Canadian Bill of Rights. And that'll include the two cases that were on the reading list for today's class. So if you haven't read them, take a look at them. I can go through this fairly quickly. And then I'll get into some very important division of powers cases, and these will be part of your presentations in the February class, as well as another very important human rights case, Roncarelli versus Du Plessis, which is you can click onto from my website. Then in the March class, we'll be looking at 12 important charter rights decisions. Good. Well, you've been a great class. Thank you for getting all the through the boring parts. We'll be dealing with more hot button issues in the future. And any questions before we go? As I mentioned earlier, after I've answered your questions and so on, I'll be heading to the absent, and then eventually to the orange bowl. But I have these three copies of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms that you can have if you want to take them home with you and put them on your wall.